Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun, two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello and welcome to the International School Podcast. Dan Taylor here. I hope you're all having a great start to 2020. It's been super busy for me. Actually, I had quite a relaxed first 2 weeks. I went skiing to Austria. I always do that with a family. I've been going there for a long time. I actually used to work in a ski school there. So we always spend the start of the year in the mountains. And then the third week of January is the BET show, B-E-T-T, which probably many of you know. It's a big education technology trade show. Apps Events was heavily involved there. We were helping on the Google Teaching Theater. We were helping with Anywhere School at a Google office in town, and we were helping with Acer. So we had a lot of people, about 14 people working there. Really hectic four-day event, but I kind of like it. You know, it kicks off the year with a bang. You get to meet everyone. People come from all around the world. So really busy, really hectic, but great. Now I'm back in Prague, actually traveling again very soon. I'm lucky enough to be going to Mountain View, to Google's headquarters in Silicon Valley on Saturday, actually. There's an annual PD partner event where obviously Apps Events is a PD partner. Heading out now, which is going to be great. A few days, get to see some friends in San Francisco, get to learn what's going on with Google education in 2020. So really, really excited. A few really quick things. First of all, if you haven't checked out our events, go to appsevents.com. We have a lot of really cool events coming up. We've got Google Educator certification boot camp. So remember, you can become Google Educator level 1 or 2. Come to one of our one-day boot camps. We cover all the material. Get certified. Get something great for your CV, and also get something that's going to help you in your career. We've got it coming up in Seattle in the US in March. That's going to be amazing. And a lot of European events. Check it out. We've got a huge summit in London with lots of really innovative ways of learning, new boot camps, new workshops. Going to be really, really interesting. We've got Prague boot camps. We've got Switzerland boot camps and summit. Italy, Rome, summit. Serbia, which is fantastic. First time in Serbia, a new country for us. So check it out. A lot of Asian events coming up soon. We're going to be announcing a big summit in Phuket in October, which is going to be amazing. But we haven't quite got all the details. We've got that coming very, very soon, probably next week. If you would like to host an event at your school, go to appsevents.com, click on host an event. We can send you more information. It's really, really easy for you as a school to host an educator bootcamp or a summit. It's a great way to get your staff trained and to increase both your profile and the profile of your school in the Google world. So highly recommend it. Every school we've worked with always wants to host again. That's kind of the best feedback we can get, really. And finally, some big news for Apps Events. Probably many of you know ISTE. We're huge fans of ISTE. We've been going to the ISTE conference for many years and following a lot of the ISTE standards in our training. We're now delighted to announce we're an ISTE partner, only the second ISTE partner outside the US. And we're running the ISTE Certified Educator Bootcamp all around the world. So please get in touch. Same form, appsevents.com. Click on host an event. And we can give you all the information about how you can host an ISTE bootcamp, get your staff certified, get people from other countries coming. Really fantastic experience. And we're going to be running a lot of these bootcamps. So please get in touch now to make sure you get your place because it's going to fill up. That's all. And now onto the interview with John Micton. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. Today I'm delighted to be welcoming returning co-host guest John Micton from the International School of Luxembourg. How are you doing, John?
Great, and happy New Year's to you, Dan.
Yeah, happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to everyone listening. It's interesting, you know, we started this podcast towards kind of middle to fourth quarter last year, and you know, I didn't really have a goal, but it's been great. You know, it's nice to start getting emails, people listening to it. You know, like, you know, the way we did it, it was never to sort of promote anything. It was just, you know, what I found with podcasting is you can get to talk to a lot of interesting people. Because I run two podcasts. I run this one and one called the Events Podcast, which is all about people running events. And in both cases, you get to talk to some really interesting people. And actually, podcasting is a networking tool. People don't realize it. And I didn't realize it till I started doing it. But you can say, hey, I run a podcast. And someone else who might be too busy to take your call, you know, 9 times out of 10 is happy to jump on and have a chat on a podcast.
Yeah, that's great. No. And I was, you know, we were just talking before about how on the International Educators Technology Group, you're getting a lot of traction from the podcast, which is great.
It's a good thing to encourage students as well in terms of publishing, you know, being a creator, not a consumer. We talked about that on another episode. And it's very easy to do now. There's a bunch of tools and you can easily, like with this podcast, you know, there's a tool called Podbean. There's a bunch of free tools and you can push it out to Spotify, to Apple Podcasts, to all the Android clients, to YouTube, you know, everywhere and really get it out. So I think that's great. And I think the mistake people make is, I think this is the same problem with people who create content on YouTube is they run it and they only get like 10, 20 people listening and then they get a bit disillusioned and they just stop doing it, you know?
But I think you have to be persistent and it takes time to build an audience.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time. I mean, I'm talking like when I talk to people, I've got a friend, Simon Whistler. You check him out online. He's a friend in Prague. He's you know, he's got millions of YouTube users and podcast viewers and it takes years. And the other thing I think to mention to anyone thinking of doing a podcast is like, it doesn't matter. Like you're not NPR. You don't need like 10 million people to listen to your podcast. You know,
no.
if you connect to 30 interesting people and maybe, you know, you get some new connections out of it. Maybe you get a job out of it. Maybe you get invited to speak at an event. Maybe you help somebody else out. Like the numbers aren't as important as if you're reaching the people you want to reach.
Absolutely. Interesting.
Yeah. So today we're going to have a chat about digital citizenship to digital fluency. We talked before about digital citizenship, so we're going to maybe move it on a little bit. So do you want to kick things off, John?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, I was with a group of 10th and 11th graders and, you know, digital citizenship, they kind of roll their eyes because I think we've done a lot and often the stance is about what not to do.
Yep.
And I think they feel that they already know, they self-regulate. And I think many young adolescents actually have quite a good understanding of what are the pitfalls and what not to do and do and, you know, with passwords and what is a good picture. And I think sometimes we need to move beyond that to this idea of digital fluency, which is more broad and really talks about the aspect of digital citizenship, but also device management and privacy and safety management, you know, managing your online presence, your passwords, two-step verification, using an authenticator. I think all those things have become really important. They're kind of the package of what you need to survive in today's digital world. And I think we need to kind of evolve this digital citizenship to this idea of digital fluency. And I think, you know, one of the great resources that I think we've talked before is the digital intelligence framework out of Singapore, the DQ Institute, is this idea that there are really, we want users, young adolescents, to move away from being consumers of content to creators of content. And this idea of using digital creativity and digital entrepreneurship as a way to leverage their ability to solve problems and engage in this ecosystem where they're more active and solution focused and problem driven and critical thinkers than just this consumption and being entertained to a certain level of numbness. So I think that's kind of the shift that I think would be interesting for more of us in the education field to start exploring, is how do we leverage that, not only with our students, but with the staff and, of course, our parent community. Yeah. So I think that I'm done.
I was going to just jump in about the digital framework? What was the name?
Yes. DQ Institute. They're out of Singapore, and they have what they call the Digital Intelligence Framework. This happened about 2014. The founder, Dr. Yuyun Park, came up with this article at the World Economic Forum. And basically, their mission is digital intelligence is a comprehensive set of technical, cognitive, metacognitive, and social emotional competencies that are grounded in universal moral values and that enable individuals to face the challenges and harness the opportunities of digital life.
Now,
so that's kind of their mission statement.
Are there any universal moral values?
That's a very good question. And I think their stance is to be agnostic and not, you know, have an international audience. So those could vary depending your circumstance and your cultural circumstance. But I think it's the idea. I think that the main value is that being nice and polite and looking to solve problems more than create problems might be what that is. And that might be a great podcast interview, is talking to Dr. Yuyun Park about this, you know, this idea of these digital intelligences. But I really think it's coming to grips with the idea that kids need to know about network security management. You know, when they're on a Wi-Fi at the airport, know that it's open and that information is quite easy to grab. You know, what is content creation? And you were just talking about podcasting. You know, if you create something in YouTube, understanding that it takes time and that you have to kind of leverage that with, you know, networking and tweeting out. So I think all these different workflows that are tied to digital life, the digital citizenship, the digital creativity, and the digital entrepreneurship are all things that we need. And I know, Dan, in your case, you use them every day. But what are we doing in schools to really engage kids to understand that and help them harness these skills? And I think different schools do it at different levels. But I'm not sure we have collectively come to an understanding that this is something that's really important and should be front and center of the education landscape.
It's interesting. So if we start off with like talking about teachers, educators, people who work for international schools, most people who are listening to this podcast, you know, like if you think of all these tools about maintaining an online profile, it actually takes a lot of time. I was thinking about it the other day, like, you know, if you go back 10 years, you know, your external, you might have had a blog, a few people did, you did, but that was a small minority of people. You know, you had a CV which you updated periodically when you were looking for a new job, maybe a LinkedIn profile. But if you think now, all the channels I have that are public, I mean, I have this podcast, I have obviously my LinkedIn profile, which I spend some time on, my Twitter profile, which is public, I spend some time on, Instagram profile. I'm also sort of active in a few Facebook groups, over content on the blog and things. Like, there's actually a lot of things which, you know, in terms of me, like just thinking to stay relevant to maintain a network, it's actually quite a bit of time and effort. And I think, you know, the people we know are really active in this, but like a lot of teachers and educators are not really active. They do the minimum. They maybe update things only when they're looking for a new job, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, is the complexity of this. And I think for kids, you know, they have this whole social media profile, be it on TikTok or Snapchat or Instagram. But the thing is, when they move at, say, 18, 19 into a university area and then think about profession, what are we doing to help them curate that professional footprint? And I think that's really important. And how do you get them to understand? You need to separate, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a social media presence and being social and entertaining and putting silly things up that your friends find funny. But you also need to understand the importance of having that professional digital footprint. And I'm not sure often as schools, we've come to terms what that looks like and how do we go about doing that? And how do we make that important in a day that's chock block full of other things that are important?
I think a lot of the issue is a lot of educators don't understand it and don't have much of a social media. I mean, the people we know do have that kind of profile, but that's the minority, you know. I think a lot don't. And so because the teachers themselves don't have the knowledge about how to build up a good external profile online, they don't know how to transfer that knowledge to the children.
Yes, I agree. And I think, you know, many people have a social profile, which is Facebook. I would say most educators that are in the group of, say, 35 to 60, that's going to be kind of an Instagram. Those are, you know, the more common. And I agree. I think, you know, what can we do as educators in schools to support teachers to maybe understand these competencies and why they're important? And how do you make those connections with their own life and their own professional discourse to understand that this is something kids need to be equipped with? And, you know, too often I hear teachers say, oh, they're digital natives and they know everything. Kids actually are not digital natives, in my personal opinion. They're digital consumers. They're very good at consumption. But most kids don't know how a phone works. And most kids don't understand what a user agreement is and what cookies and tracking and all this other kind of, not dark side, but this commercial aspect of our information being curated to generate profit. Those things we, most kids don't know about. And I think as teachers, the one thing that we have that kids don't have is we have lifelong learning experience. We have wisdom. We have the capacity to be critical thinkers, to problem solve. And those ethical and value things are what really we can bring to the table that are lacking. I don't think we need to teach kids how to use Facebook or whatever it might be, but we need to teach them about being critical thinkers and balance. What are the opportunities and challenges, and what are the ways I can leverage this in creating content and being an entrepreneur or a digital creator of something that's very positive and that's going to support me?
Yeah, definitely. What else? Anything else on ethics and values? I mean, is that something? What? How can that be? We're talking about digital citizenship, digital fluency. Like, how can ethics and values, like, be communicated in a way? Like, how could a school actually do that in practice?
That's a really good question. I think one thing is you know, creating situations, actually case studies or, you know, role plays where kids actually are thrown into a situation where they have to make this decision and problem solve and do some critical thinking. You know, if I post this about a friend and it has a negative impact, what is my responsibility to undo that? Or how can I make sure, what are some, you know, just psychological or just, you know, reasons that I can think about before? What can I set myself up that I have some filters or processes before I post something or generate discourse that creates a negative impact? I think that is, you know, we all very likely in my generation and your generation, we had some type of education and values and what's right and wrong, be it in a non-formal setting or formal setting. And I think it's about getting kids to understand that their digital experience on the phone, there's a high level of curation and somebody choreographing their experiences. What does that mean ethically for you as an individual if what you see on the internet actually is not what you have kind of independently with free will decided upon? It's based on an aggregation of your online behavior, and then the companies predict what your behavior might be, so they deliver that content based on that behavior. I think that's a big question.
But now we're talking about the ethics of the companies doing that, not the ethic, not teaching students ethics. That's like, you know, it's teaching students that you're a pawn in somebody else's game and you're being served content, you know, for generally speaking, you're being served content that'll that people want to advertise against that can make the company money by selling ads, which is usually the way most of these platforms are generating money, you know?
Yes, exactly. And
or selling your data, or selling your data as a user in terms of, you know, what you're doing.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk to kids, they generally don't mind that the companies have their data. What they don't want is their parents to know their data, which is interesting. While I think somebody from my generation that knew was part of a world where privacy was very different, I'm a much more uncomfortable with what, you know, Shoshana Zuboff says in her book, this age of surveillance capitalism. I'm much more uncomfortable with this. I think for me, what the fluency, the digital fluency, is getting kids to understand, at least be aware of this and understand what are the moral implications. Why is it good or why is it bad? What are the positives and negatives? Because the fact is, most of these kids in the long run are going to be either programming the new social media, are going to be in decision-making positions with artificial intelligence. And if we don't equip them with some greater capacity to be critically thinking, and also some of these moral questions that they have, a greater understanding of the balance between the two, I think it becomes kind of dangerous if we don't address it, because we need them to understand there are pros and cons. And if they better understand the world that they are in currently, they might decide, you know what, I'm not okay with everybody taking all my information and turning around. So when I design this new app, I'm going to make sure it doesn't have this tracking aspect. And I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that we're not going to change the world, but we want to make sure that kids are equipped with enough critical thinking skills and awarenesses of how this all works and what are the challenges and opportunities and what are some of the implications.
Yeah, can you tell us more about the book you mentioned, Surveillance Capitalism? Who was the author and what did they talk about?
Yeah, so The Age of Surveillance Capitalism is by a professor called Shoshana Zuboff. And it's quite a big book. It's over 1,000 pages, and I think with about 250 footnotes. It's not something that you read lightly. It's really voluminous and extremely well researched. And what she talks about is this idea of behavior surplus, is the personal data that we leave on our devices and give away daily based on the user agreements we make with these companies. So when you accept the cookies or you accept a user agreement, this agreement basically is giving permission to companies to monitor our behavior, not only online, but offline. And they basically track, collect, monitor, and analyze this. And then they turn this around into being able to better predict what we will do, and that gets sold to companies. So an insurance company might be coming into a city, and with this behavior surplus, they'll know how many people might have had issues with breast cancer, how many people are really fit, and that information allows them to curate a different policy because they have much more information and know what are some of the variables that might give them the edge in being able to sell that product.
It's only probably a few steps away from insurance companies then denying certain people coverage based on what factors they can find out about their health from things online and things like that, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's the darker side of this is, you know, as companies have more of this information and longitudinally, what does that mean for the idea of free will? And, you know, if you go on a march or you in a demo and then now we are seeing it, you know, you had mentioned it when we were offline, this whole tracking in China and these social points. You know, I think people often don't realize Facebook is not really interested in me. They're interested in my behaviors and the behaviors that I associate with other behaviors. So when I post pictures, it's not really my face they're interested in. They're interested in all the faces I'm putting up and getting their AI to start better understanding how to recognize these different faces. So my Facebook feed really is a playground for a lot of this technology to try things out and better learn and better understand, so that then can be used for a different purpose. So for example, maybe facial recognition is then sold to a company or to a government, and then they have a better hold on a group of people based on this technology.
Yeah, definitely. Another book I recommend, I actually got it for Christmas. My wife got me it for Christmas, is Permanent Record, the Edward Snowden book. Have you read that?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've actually, that's on my list. How is that? That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, much easier read by the sounds of it than the Age of Surveillance Capitalism. It's a really interesting story. You know, he gets into his whole background working for CIA as an operative and then as a contractor. And how he discovered that the government was basically taking kind of a host pipe from all these, from the phone companies, from Facebook, from everyone, at Microsoft, and just getting everyone's, you know, data, which isn't supposed to be the case. So it's much more focused on government getting your data than the companies. But then he just gets into his whole story, which is amazing. You know, I guess, you know, he was on the run. He ended up in Hong Kong. He was trying to get to Ecuador and then ended up getting stopped in Russia when they managed to cancel his passport when he was on transit in Russia, so that's why he kind of got stuck there. But a really, really fascinating book, and I recommend everyone to read it.
Excellent. So Dan, I'm wondering, in your role, you're an entrepreneur, you have a company, you work with many different people. How does, you know, this kind of idea of digital intelligence, is people understanding, you know, how to manage their networks, to manage your online profile, having a good understanding of how to promote and use social media for professional capacity. How important is that to the people that you work with and that you hire and get to support you in training and things like that? Is that something that you consider?
Yeah, it's everything. I mean, if somebody, like, if you take, say, someone who's going to present, like, you know, we run a lot of boot camps for Google, and actually we're going to have a new announcement, which I can't make yet, but we're going to be working with on some of the really interesting boot camps very soon, and summits. Like, if you have a presenter who has a big social media reach, you know, so we work with people that have a YouTube channel, or they have a podcast, or they have just a lot of Twitter followers, like, it makes a difference. You know, you want to work with them. I guess as an entrepreneur, like, we talked a lot about the downsides of these things, but as an entrepreneur, you focus on the pluses, because unless you're kind of an idiot, you're not getting involved in flame wars and online. You're not, like, posting, you know, questionable material. You just kind of know that, you know, you don't do that. It's not going to help you, you know?
Exactly. And I think that's so important is, you know, I think, you know, we need to understand there's a lot of positive about all this, and there's a lot of ways that we can better the world and change it, I think. And I think your point's a really important one.
Yeah, I mean, like I said right at the beginning, I mean, just doing this podcast, take a really simple thing. This is a really, you know, it's focused on international school educators. It's a lot of fun. Like, you know, like I mentioned, I get right now 3 or 4 emails a week from people I don't know who listen to it. You know, that number's going up. You know, 6 months ago, it was nobody was emailing me, you know. And obviously, you know, it's like the point, I guess, the interesting point from an entrepreneur type of viewpoint is it takes a lot of time. You know, you can't deny that. Like, to me, to do these 2 podcasts, just to update everything, it's a part-time job, you know.
Yeah.
That's the reality.
Yeah. And for you, I mean, when you have a trainer that comes on board, do you check their social media to make sure they're not, you know, representing something that your organization doesn't? I mean, are you looking for that professional social media imprint over the more social? Is that important?
I think it's even more connected than that. I think most trainers who get in touch with us, or we find out about, it's through their online profile. You know, I think that's how we know about them in the first place. I mean, in some cases, it's just a straight introduction from someone, or someone that comes to one of our events. But more and more as we get bigger, it's just like we'll be interacting with someone online, and we'll see they're in the same kind of, you know, Google for education interest. And then we'll get in touch with them about presenting it, or often they'll just inquire, you know. So I think it's even deeper. It's actually, you know, the reason we work with a lot of people now is it's online first, as opposed to social proof trumps everything. If you recommend someone and someone you trust recommends someone else, that always beats online. But more and more, you know, people are coming through the online, not the recommendation route, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And if you were thinking, you know, if you had to tell some young, I would say 11th or 12th graders are about to go to university and are starting to think about this, what for you would be kind of the things you think they would have to have under their belt, you know, kind of some of the digital creativity, digital entrepreneurship skills? What would you be looking for in somebody if you hire somebody?
You know, what I would say to someone like that is I think – get comfortable with putting yourself out there, because I can say myself, it was, you know, until really recently, you know, even after I met you, there was barely a picture of me online. I wasn't, you know, anything I posted under would be under apps events. I didn't have my own Twitter account even, you know, I didn't like putting myself out there, and I'm still a bit reluctant. I'm still just getting started on for YouTube, for example. So I think, like, you know, not everyone has to be super outgoing, but I think it's good to start putting yourself out there at a young age, getting used to the benefits it can bring, and also dealing with the downsides. You know, like, you get people who leave crappy reviews and call you an idiot. Like, it just happens, you know? And yeah, the first time it happens, you're like, oh, you know, the world's going to end. And then, you know, honestly, once like 10 people have called you an idiot, you think, well, you know, is it always I'm being an idiot, or have they got an agenda? And then, you know, you look at the other things they're posting, and you can usually decide if it is your fault or theirs, you know? So I think getting involved in putting yourself out there slowly for a young person is really, really useful skill.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Some schools actually, what they do is they give a premium account to LinkedIn as a graduation present to their graduates.
That's a really interesting point. I pay for LinkedIn Sales Navigator. It's about $500 a year, 500 euros a year, and it allows you to connect to more people. And I've actually started using that as a relationship building. You know, I basically invite, you know, a bunch of contacts every week, people I'm interested to connect to. Just really just send them a basic message saying, hey, I'm looking to connect. It looks like we have similar interests. And, you know, seven, eight times out of 10, they'll just say, yeah. And, you know, often there's not much more. Sometimes you'll get into a chat, but it's interesting. You know, I think that LinkedIn is a really, like in education and ed tech, everyone's focused 100% on Twitter, and I think everyone's missed the boat. I think LinkedIn is more important than Twitter, actually.
It's interesting that you say that, because I've definitely found that over the last maybe 18 months that I'm spending more time on LinkedIn, and the content on LinkedIn is much richer than what I'm often getting in Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn is still, the UI is not great. It's still, you can get a lot of crap on your homepage. You've got to dig around a little bit sometimes, but yeah. I think LinkedIn is, you know, I think in education, we're kind of late to the game. If you look at just normal business in general, especially enterprise business, big business, like everyone, YouTube is, LinkedIn is where it's at. No one cares about Twitter. Oh, it's just very much second. I think in our world, it's always been Twitter, you know?
Yes, I think educators really gravitate and like that format.
Yeah, and I think it's moving to LinkedIn. I think everyone should be building up their profile there. You know, it's been around a long time. It's survived the Microsoft takeover. Normally, like Microsoft, it's a kiss of death for a product, you know, when they acquire, but LinkedIn seems to have flourished under Microsoft, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, for kids to have a public profile and how to kind of curate that positive digital footprint compared to what they're doing in their social media footprint is a really good conversation, because it's very two different types of workflows. And I think this whole idea of the digital fluency is, let's expand what we provide, not only about don't go online or social media is bad, but how do we leverage these tools to create content and be an entrepreneur to really kind of make a difference and take advantage of the skills that we have and be able to amplify them through these different online contents.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like LinkedIn because it's all business, you know, there's no gray area. I think the people get into trouble with Facebook and Twitter, Facebook maybe more, where, you know, they're doing business posts, but they're also chatting with their friends normally. That's generally private, but then the kind of third part of it is just them getting involved in discussions about politics and things, which usually get pretty, you know, aggro. And then, and that's kind of mixed in. And Twitter as well, same problem, you know? I think that's a potential danger for people, like, is, and that's why I was saying before about, you know, responding to a comment in your group, which I didn't do in the end. Like, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble by getting into arguments in kind of public groups, or maybe they're not public, but there's a lot of people in the group, you know, a lot of people will see this. And yeah, that could count against you, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, there are some schools that also are looking with even younger kids, what is a compliment, what's a comment and what's a compliment? And what does a comment look like? And, you know, how do you build a good comment where, first of all, you thank the person or highlight the positive about their response, and then you might give some constructive feedback. And really getting kids to understand that that's what happens in a professional context, but when you're in your social media, it doesn't matter, you know, it does. But being able to distinguish between the two, because I know sometimes when you work with kids and you start having them comment or go on to a discussion board, a forum, it quickly turns into a chat room, and then you realize, well, they actually don't have that point of reference. So I think that's, again, an example of some of the digital fluencies that I've been mentioning about is
And you've got to ask yourself, why are you commenting? I mean, I know, like, it's really kind of an overused phrase, but are you just virtue signaling? Are you just showing I'm really great and your opinion is bad and I'm great, and because I made this post, I'm, you know, a good person, a better person than you? Like, is that why you're doing it? Because that's why a lot of people post. And I think, we're all guilty of this. No, anyone who says they're out is lying, you know. So, but I reckon I delete like 9 out of 10 posts I'm going to write. I write it and then I'm like, is that why I'm going to do this post, just to make myself look good? And then I'm like, I'm just not going to do it. What's the point? You know, it's not going to advance any discussion. You know, I think how you said to do it, you know, is start with a compliment, you know, and look to engage. I mean, it's a tough job, but if people can do that, that will make the online world a better place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the fact that you're describing this idea that you post and then you have that critical capacity to really self-reflect and say, is this really good or not? And I think that's what I'm saying about digital fluency. We need to equip kids to know how to do that, and where it becomes just an automatic behavior, you know. And I think is, what can we cognitively support them with in, you know, being good digital citizens, but also great digital creators of content. So I think that's the message.
Great. Well, I think that's a good place to finish, John. Great to catch up again, as always.
Yes, lovely, as always, Dan. Thank you. It was a good chat.
Sounds good. Speak soon.